Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. At the start, I should say that parts of this program are my opinion and mine only in perhaps all the cosmos. And I am going to apologize in advance for the peculiar way I pronounce nuclear. It is the way my tongue wraps around the word, which I am going to say often. As most of you who are listening to this program are probably aware, this summer is the 70th anniversary of the advent of the nuclear age. Specifically, July 16th, 1945, was the date of the first human-devised nuclear explosion in history and has since been called the Day of Trinity. It was an experimental blast in the New Mexico desert to determine if the concept of nuclear explosives was feasible, and also whether such a blast would initiate a chain reaction that might shatter the planet. Two nuclear bombs were subsequently exploded by the United States over the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki the following month, August, which ended World War II, and in a wiser world might have ended warfare. Instead, a nuclear arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union divided the world for nearly half a century. The core history of the nuclear age has been a fevered contest to produce ever more lethal weapons of mass destruction and death, capable of obliterating humanity and its home planet several times over. This insanity quickly became normal geopolitical policy, and its legacy survives the Cold War that ended with the implosion of the USSR late last century. A passionate international resistance to nuclear megadeath grew in tandem with the arms race and was consequently persecuted as cowardly and disloyal by virtually every pro-nuclear government it defied. Some of you might remember what could be considered a minor but very daring act of nuclear resistance that occurred in Astoria 25 years ago, when anti-nuclear resistors confronted an American Navy battleship that was possibly armed with nuclear missiles. It happened on June 6, 1990, when the World War II battleship USS New Jersey, which fought in the Pacific during the war, including the Battle of Leyte Gulf, was stopped for the first time in its history while attempting to transit up the Columbia River past Astoria. Eight members of Greenpeace dangled 200 feet in the air on ropes from the arch of the Astoria-Megler Bridge over the shipping channel, which delayed the old battleship at least 4 hours during its voyage to that year's Portland Rose Festival. The Coast Guard offered to clear the bridge of protesters, but the New Jersey's captain responded that he did not wish to start an incident, saying that those dangling from the bridge were as much Americans as his crew and had the right to dissent that his sailors were in service to defend. Greenpeace mobilized the demonstration with precision and imagination. The repellers were dropped onto the bridge from three vans, and they instantly tied off their lines and went over the side. Each was an experienced climber. Each had a survival suit and was equipped with a two-way radio with several channels and banners that said, "Nuclear Free Seas." Their purpose was to draw attention to the possibility of the New Jersey carrying nuclear weapons. The Navy neither confirms nor denies if its ships carry nuclear weapons. Clatsop County was and remains a nuclear-free zone, voted into law by 60% of county voters, though Astoria has no such ordinance. Greenpeace pulled off the exploit with the assistance of a local group opposed to the proposed establishment of a Navy home port in Astoria, Nuclear-Free Harbors. Hardly noticed by media accounts of the fair was that the Cold War nuclear arms race had for the most part gone undersea in Navy submarines or out of sight of voters on the ocean surface in naval vessels such as New Jersey. which made land-based sites increasingly obsolete, except as bargaining commodities by the competing superpowers who were able to carry out treaty obligations while continuing the arms race. Local officials responded angrily. Astoria's mayor at the time said the protest did not represent Astoria citizens and that outside agitators, quote-unquote, were responsible. In the meantime, Clatsop County commissioners attempted to dismantle the nuclear free zone by claiming that the law was legally unenforceable and politically untenable. The climbers did not intend to drop onto the battleship as authorities claimed, yet there was fear that the tall ship would collide with one or more of them, which caused the delay. Finally, after the captain was convinced no one was to be hurt, the New Jersey passed under the bridge. Two climbers raised up several feet to assure themselves of clearance. All were arrested and initially held without bail after they climbed back onto the bridge. After several hours in jail, bond was set at $30,000 apiece. Astoria attorney Elizabeth Baldwin finally got them bailed out for $5,000, $500 each, despite the anger of the district attorney, who wished them to pay dearly for their descent and possible endangering home porting of Navy vessels in Astoria, an idea that later disintegrated with the implosion of the Soviet Union and end of the Cold War. A quarter of a century later, some Astorians might still remain angry at what they considered at the time willful embarrassment of Astoria by Greenpeace, if they even remember the incident. Yet many others expressed satisfaction that Astoria was chosen to confront the Navy's nuclear policies and its arrogant defiance of Clatsop County's nuclear free zone. "We aren't anti-American," one of the Greenpeace climbers said at the time. "We actually care a great deal about the United States to try to make it as peaceful as possible, as good as possible." Another said he was not against the Navy, but "we are against nuclear weapons. We felt we needed to do this, and getting arrested comes with the territory," said a third. And so it acts as a prologue to an article which Jim Wilkins wrote about the incident, and he published it in my newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, in July 1990, the July issue. And I'd like to read what Jim wrote. "The Green People Were Here, Nuclear Warship in Port," by Jim Wilkins. The call came Friday afternoon from a member of the local environmental group, Nuclear Free Harbors. "Would you be willing to provide office space for Greenpeace for a few days next week?" It sounded like fun to me, so I agreed I would be interested. "I'll call their people right now in Seattle and they'll contact you." Within 10 minutes, I was on the line with Chris Diebel, who said that her organization would be staging some sort of rally to protest the presence of a Navy ship carrying nuclear weapons. "We have some special needs for this action," she said. "Specifically, direct line of sight to Cape Disappointment, the Columbia River Bar, and the Astoria-Megler Bridge." As she named each location, I glanced outside my window in my house on Floral Avenue at Cape D, the bar, and the bridge. "I think I have the perfect spot for you." "Great," she replied. "I'll have our man in San Francisco get in touch with you." The next morning, as I was working at a Rotary Club project sprucing up the old fire hall in Uppertown, the mobile phone in my car sounded the horn. I ran out to receive the call, which turned out to be from Dick Dillman, who said he would be coordinating the action here for Greenpeace. He said my office space sounded ideal for his needs, and he would fly up the following day for a first-person look. I had no idea what the action was or what these people had up their sleeve. I do know that nuclear weapons are insane and have no place on this planet, especially a few hundred yards from my window aboard a Navy ship of a design that tends to explode at random intervals, and I am always ready to help anyone who shares this opinion. I'm not a member of Greenpeace and, at the time, knew little about the organization. My image of them was something of a hippie type with raggedy clothes, long hair, and a slightly goofy look about them. Boy, I had that all wrong. The next afternoon, Dick arrived in a rented station wagon filled with radios, antennae, transmitters, and all the accoutrements one would expect a professional electronics man to carry. I was on my way to get takeout pizza, so I quickly showed him the room we would provide, actually the office of my wife, Regina, who was kind enough to clear all her papers out of the way. The next day was Monday, which meant for me going back to work, trying to stay on top of my construction business. I visited with Dick off and on during the day as he set up an amazing array of communications gear. He is a 13-year veteran of Greenpeace and a former member of their board of directors. He is very bright, very articulate, and clearly very committed. He and most of the others I met are on salary. Doing this kind of stuff is their job. We found we had a lot in common. We both are private pilots. We're both about the same age. We have a similar education. And we both see the survival of the human species as somewhat questionable given the current trend in world society. My type of activism can be described as, to quote René Dubos, think globally, act locally. Dick thinks globally, and he acts globally. Greenpeace is a worldwide outfit with an annual budget in this country alone of about $40 million. Tuesday, the rest of their people started filtering in from around the country. Some stayed in motel rooms. Others stayed with local citizens. Our mayor was quoted in the Daily Astorian saying that most of the protesters were from out of town. They did not represent the views of the people who live here. I talked with a whole lot of locals who were very receptive to Greenpeace and quite appreciative of their presence here. I doubt, however, that the four class of county commissioners who trampled the will of the people by gutting our nuclear-free zone ordinance shared this feeling. Nor, I suppose, did the three Astoria City Council members who ignored a clearly represented majority of opinion by voting to clear-cut 30 acres of publicly owned timber inside our city limits. Nor, come to think of it, does the judge who suspended the constitutional and statutory right of people to bail to keep the protesters in jail illegally? But I'm getting ahead of myself. The Green People, as I had started to call them, found an unusual amount of support locally and were delighted at the reception they were receiving in Astoria. Dick told me they had never felt so welcomed by a community. Wednesday, June 6th, was the day of the action. I was having a hard time doing business while, in the next office, I could hear the Greenpeace spotter plane report the first sighting of the battleship New Jersey about 10 miles off the coast. Finally, about 10 that morning, I told Dick I had to go check on the job. "You better stick around," he said. "It will start to happen in about a minute." I didn't know what it was, so he told me to focus my binoculars on the center span of the Astoria-Megler Bridge. Just as I did, I saw three white vans come to a quick stop, equally spaced across the span. The side door slid open, and six or eight brilliantly clad people jumped out of each one. The vans roared off toward the toll plaza, and within a minute or two, eight people were dangling down on ropes, with one person, or attendee, as they were called, staying above each climber to make sure all the knots stayed tied. As the ramifications of this scene started to come clear to me, my respect for these green persons climbed several notches. The image of the lone Chinese student facing a very large tank in Tiananmen Square last year, which was 1989, came quickly to mind. Within 10 or 15 minutes, the local law enforcement agencies jumped into action. From our perch in my house, we could watch as they tried to sort it out and listen to them on Dick's radio receivers as they considered their options. Throughout the rest of the day, the police would continue to operate in a very professional and compassionate manner. Word quickly reached the New Jersey, delaying its entrance into the river until the situation became more clear. There was a lot of concern about what these people were going to do and what they had in the black bags dangling under each climber. One by one, the green people reached into their bags and unfurled a banner saying, "Nuclear Free Seas, Greenpeace." that answered the question of the contents of the bags. But would these folks actually lower themselves down to impede the passage of the battleship? We will neither confirm nor deny, was the response given by Dick Dillman, the same phrase used by the Navy when asked about the presence of nuclear weapons on their ships. Joining us that morning was Brian Hinman from Washington, D.C. He was constantly on the phone to someone back there, relaying a play-by-play of the action. The radios were really beginning to hum about now. We could hear the New Jersey talking to the Coast Guard, the climbers talking to their attendees, the attendees relaying questions from law enforcement people on the bridge to Dick here at the Command Central, and Brian on the phone to the mysterious presence from Washington, D.C., all at the same time. Dick had a UHF transceiver, a VHF transceiver, a UHF VHF AM/FM programmable scanner, an aviation transceiver, and a couple of handheld radios, all wired to a small forest of antennae clamped to my desk. A constant stream of green people came and went, trying to keep up with the action on several fronts while preparing for the rally planned for noon under the Astoria Bridge at Uniontown Park. The energy level was approaching maximum right here on Floral Avenue. The Navy finally put one of their people aboard a Coast Guard helicopter for a first-hand look at the situation. After a few close flybys, the Navy man returned to the battleship, which then decided to commit to the channel. I am not really sure, but I think at this point the Green people had met their objective, to delay the entrance of New Jersey into the Columbia River Channel. The rest of the action would revolve around the neither confirm nor deny game with the Navy. Dick would continue to claim that the climbers would make their own decision individually whether to lower themselves into the battleship's path, but I think that decision had been made much earlier. We watched the New Jersey as it crossed the bar and worked its way up the channel. A small flotilla of boats accompanying the New Jersey, but no closer than 200 yards. Some carried American flags. Others carried banners with such sayings as, "Peace is patriotic," and "No floating Chernobyls." A report came in from one of the Green people's Zodiacs that an Exxon oil tanker tied up at the face of Pier 1 at the port of Astoria was sporting a banner visible only from the river saying, "Bleep, Greenpeace." The irony of that banner was not lost on the Green people. Slowly, the massive ship approached the bridge. The thing sticks out of the water about 165 feet, and the bridge span is about 205. The two middle climbers had to shinny up their rope a little to leave a safety margin. The New Jersey had turned off its powerful fire control radar system, which could have turned the climbers into little toasty green burgers. The passage was slow, uneventful, and anticlimactic. The crowds dispersed. The climbers clambered up to be arrested, and the radios were shut down. Those green people not in jail gathered across the river on the Washington side, where they had rented some cottages to review the action and maybe have a tall, cold one. In a move far more illegal than trespassing on the Astoria Bridge, Judge Cole announced that afternoon that he was suspending all bail for misdemeanor charges and then promptly left town. This action was apparently requested by the district attorney's office, but I am not sure why. These green people are bright, educated kids, fully patriotic in the best American tradition. Many of them were raised in small towns like Astoria, and many of the best and brightest of our local young people left their hometowns after high school to learn more about the big world out there. What they learned was that we humans have backed ourselves into an exceedingly tight corner on this planet. And if large changes are not made very soon, civilization as we know and love it will have a hard time surviving the next couple of hundred years. Substantial changes are needed worldwide in our societies, our institutions, and our consciousness. and the green people are trying everything they can think of to effect those changes in a timely manner. This, to me, is real patriotism. After the eight climbers and two attendees spent the night as guests of Sheriff Joe Brunick at the Clatsop County Jail, their attorney, Beth Baldwin, finally rounded up a retired judge, former chief judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, and later Cannon Beach Mayor, Herbert Schwab, who agreed to recess a jury trial early to hold the bail hearing. Doug Jensen, from the DA's office, demanded $30,000 bail for each climber for a misdemeanor charge. His ability to keep a straight face while making these demands amazed me, as well as the judge, who finally set bail at $5,000 per defendant late Thursday afternoon. This meant posting a little over $500 for each green person. Greenpeace organizers came prepared to post that bail amount, and within an hour, all 10 were back on the street. That night, I was reclining in front of the TV, watching the second Blazer game in Detroit. Things didn't look good for Clyde and the boys as the final minutes of the game approached. Lambier made a three-pointer to put the Pistons in the lead, but Clyde made those two free throws to pull the game out in OT. Just as at the buzzer, the phone rang. It was Dick calling from the Columbian Cafe. "We're all down here eating and drinking beer," he said over the sounds of a loud and happy crowd. "We would really enjoy it if you would come down and join us." I drove down to the cafe, owned by Uriah Hulsey, a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And as I walked through the door, they all stood up and cheered. Dick gave a spiel about the pleasure of meeting such a fine group of people in Astoria. And I gave a spiel about the pleasure of meeting such a fine group of people not from Astoria. And the beer was good. I will keep memories of that evening and that week for a long, long time. And that was Green People Are Here, Warship in Port by Jim Wilkins. He lives in Astoria and is a former owner of a construction company, plays music in a variety of venues with varied musicians and hosts, Friday with Jim Wilkins on KMUN. And he wrote this story for the North Coast Times-Eagle in July 1990. And I'd like to finish this program with something about the attorney for the Greenpeace people, Elizabeth Baldwin, a fierce and brave heart. And I wrote this, so my disclaimer still holds, I believe. Beth Baldwin died November 11th, 2002. She was born in 1949. On what was originally Armistice Day, an irony because she never made a truce with anything or anybody in her lifelong fight for justice as an attorney and as a person, legal, political, and personal. Another irony might be the portion of her cremated ashes interred in a round red can of roll-ready cigarette tobacco, which more or less killed her. The rest of her ashes are in a small red cedar box with a Haida symbol of the Bear Clan engraved on its sides. A Haida man she once defended for beating up a cop who attempted to arrest him for urinating in a public place said she was a spiritual member of the Bear Clan, strong and indomitable. That she certainly was. This is what a longtime courtroom opponent, Clatsop County District Attorney Josh Marquis, said of Beth after she died. "We clashed frequently on legal matters, but everyone who dealt with Beth knew her to be a formidable and well-prepared lawyer. She was zealous in defense of her clients and never gave up, and always gave the prosecution a run for its money." And by the way, Josh was not DA in 1990 when the New Jersey was here. "Her invincible fighting spirit is more necessary than ever this troubled, turbulent, and repressive era since 9/11/2001. And though she died long before she should have if there were truly justice in this world, the fact her corporeal self is no longer with us does not mean her legacy has to die with her. Above all, Beth was a fierce and unrelenting advocate of the First Amendment, which states clearly and simply that government has no right to interfere with freedoms of speech, press, or religion, or with public gatherings, or the right of the people to petition government for a redress of grievances, quote unquote, which, as a lawyer and expert of constitutional law, was Beth's special advocacy. The First Amendment is the most fundamental of the Bill of Rights because it protects all the others and the rest of the amendments as well. But it is under continual assault, and no more so than since 9/11, by the Bush administration's toxic legacy, the so-called USA Patriot Act. Dissent, the most definitive and precarious form of free expression, has been especially criticized in the poisonous atmosphere of bellicose patriotism and religious intolerance, and is inferred to be treasonous because the country seems to be perpetually at war. Yet when even friends and neighbors rebuke free speech, it is essential to resist eviscerating the First Amendment and suppressing civil liberties. A distinguishedly progressive legacy for Beth should inculcate the First Amendment, an ongoing public display of free speech in Astoria, where she lived and fought so vigorously for it. A precedent for a living monument to free expression, and legal minds are notably susceptible to precedent, is a tribute to the First Amendment at the Charlottesville, Virginia City Hall. It is a 7-foot-high, 50-foot-long chalkboard on which anyone is able to write anything they wish to write. The project is sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, and to the surprise of its advocates, was approved in 2001, before 9/11, by the Charlottesville City Council. Newspaper columnist Ellen Goodwin wrote of the project, "These days we tend to think of free speech as one of those troublesome legacies of the Constitution that we have to tolerate, but not always enthusiastically." But as she wrote, "Free speech is not something chiseled in marble to be admired from afar. It is as messy and temporary and as powerful as the debate over this small space." Indeed, there was debate. People in Charlottesville feared swear words, swastikas, graffiti, and hate speech. Questions were asked about what should be read by children, a debate that obviously mirrored free speech itself. As one of the chalkboard's advocates said, "We envision the occasional racial slur, but we see 20 people responding as well." And indeed, there will be debate if Astoria were to aptly honor Beth Baldwin's memory with an identical example of free expression. The most appropriate place would be Heritage Square across the street from Astoria City Hall, an ideal fit alongside the memorial to early Chinese residents who are finally being acclaimed, and a proposed library once the accidental crater has been filled in. This is an idea Beth would support. We talked about it once or twice, though never considered it a postmortem legacy to her memory. She thought the public chalkboard more symbolic than consequential, and it seemed abnormal that the notion for a public place for people to express their thoughts and opinions should be as provocative as it was and is likely to be. Yet, as she so often said, Oregon's own state constitution has a provision even stronger than the First Amendment. Article 1, Section 8 says, "No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right." Beth could have written those words. They were straight from her fierce and courageous heart. And this has been Michael McCusker.